I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. . 2018 marks the Affordable Care Act's fourth year in force. This time around, the enrollment period is shorter, ad funding has been cut, premiums have gone up, and folks in Washington are still debating the law's merits. Nevertheless, the registration deadline is just 2 weeks away. Today, we'll make sure you know what you need to get enrolled on time. Then, the chicken. Once a humble backyard bird, America's favorite fowl now affects human health on a worldwide scale. That's in no small part thanks to the routine use of antibiotics on the birds. It's a development that's transformed modern agriculture and the way we eat. We'll find out how on Up to Date after this hour's news. The latest on the Affordable Care Act, despite higher premiums this year, despite a 90% decrease in advertising funds, despite less money for navigators who provide enrollment assistance, and despite a heated political debate over whether Obamacare should even exist, enrollment is actually ahead of last year's pace. And not just by a little, by 30%. But the deadline for enrolling looms, so now a conversation about the ins and outs and the nuts and bolts of enrolling with a good panel of experts. With us, Jessica Hembree is Program Officer for the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City. Jessica, good morning.
Thank you.
James Torres is an Affordable Care Act navigator with the Samuel U. Rogers Health Center. James, welcome back.
Oh, good morning.
Molly Moffitt is Program Manager for the Community Health Council of Wyandotte County. Molly and James were just with us a few weeks back talking about all this. And Molly, welcome back to you as well.
Yeah, good to be here.
And we're taking your questions this morning about the actual enrollment process itself. If you have a question, give us a shout, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, we talked a little bit about this last time, Molly, but what accounts for a 30% spike in enrollment, even though Obamacare has faced all these hurdles in the past year?
I honestly think people just want health insurance. And that.
Imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And since there is still financial assistance available, a lot of people are getting pretty good plans. And, I say that any publicity is good publicity. So there's been a lot of attention on it, too.
James, any other factors that are weighing into this big jump we're seeing?
Well, I think with the news, it's been in the news seemingly all year long, and people who have insurance through the marketplace are obviously concerned about losing it. And so I think it's led to an increase in interest at this point. So,
Well, let's turn to the actual process of enrolling and maybe help uncertain listeners navigate what can be a complicated set of decisions. Jessica, what's the deadline? Maybe we need to get that out of the way right here.
The deadline this year is December 15th.
So it's coming up in a couple weeks, right?
Have long, right?
Yeah. To be clear, the enrollment period is shorter this year than previous years?
Previous years, it's been about 3 months long. So this is our first time of having a six-week enrollment period.
And why is it just 6 weeks?
There was an expectation all along that we would move to a shorter enrollment period to mirror more of what private insurers are offering. This is actually a year earlier than it was expected to be moved to that shortened time frame.
Well, Molly, how flexible is that December 15th deadline? I mean, if you miss it, can you still get enrolled on December 16th, or are you out of luck?
It is not flexible at all. No, you are out of luck.
Wondering,
unless
yeah.
you had an insurance company that left the market. So like Blue Cross and Blue Shield, those folks would have a little bit longer.
Okay. Just speaking generally here, is this a complicated process, James? I mean, should people be dreading this process? Because, you know, it sounds a little tricky. You start talking about health insurance and people get a little shaky.
I don't think it's terribly complicated. I think it depends on your personal situation. If somebody's a single individual that gets paid with a paycheck, doesn't have any dependents, it's pretty simple. I mean, you can call the marketplace directly at 1-800-318-2596 or go to healthcare.gov and fill out an application in 10 or 15 minutes and probably get an answer as to whether you qualify for the financial assistance.
Yeah, I was bouncing around last night on it, and it's pretty straightforward, at least what I was looking at, you know, trying to get my own situation.
It is. But if you've got couple of more wage earners, multiple dependents, more than one generation, one household, it can get a little complicated. And we just want consumers to know that there are trained certified application counselors and navigators available throughout the metro area. And you can find them by calling the United Way at 211 from any phone in the metro area.
But we just heard there's less money this time around for navigators, implying that it might be tougher to get an actual human being on the phone to help you navigate this process. So what about that?
Well, federal government did cut back on grants to navigator organizations, but we're very fortunate in Kansas City area that foundations like the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City and the REACH Foundation have stepped in to provide some additional funding so that we do have a talented pool of trained assisters available to help.
Jessica, you're from the foundation. What are you guys doing to help on that score?
A lot of what we're doing to help is to make sure that people like Molly and Jim have what they need to do what they do. We have some of the best navigators in the whole country right here in Kansas City. They've been really creative about the work that they're doing. They're among the most knowledgeable in the nation. And despite what might be some political hurdles, I think we've had some really incredible work happening here in Kansas City to make sure that people get set up with the insurance they need.
So, James, run that by us again. Someone listening out there isn't certain how to proceed and they want to talk to somebody. What do they do again?
Basically, just pick up a phone in the metro area, dial 211, and that will connect you with the United Way's hotline. It connects people with all sorts of social services throughout the metro area. And you just tell them you want help applying for Marketplace health insurance, and they'll connect you with a navigator in your community.
Molly, it's a cliche to say it, but a lot of people might be wondering, there's no dumb questions here when it comes to how to enroll in the HCA, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And I would just make sure everyone knows to read all of the fine print. And like Jim said, you know, if you do need help, we are here, even if it's just a phone call. I answer phone calls and emails all the time because we do have a big chunk of people who are comfortable doing it themselves. But then when it comes down to, you know, some details or picking a plan, they might need some help with that.
Yeah. What are some of the most common questions that you guys get?
Common questions are about networks.
Meaning,
so like, is my doctor in network? What hospitals can I go to? And I always advise people to go to the insurance company's website because healthcare.gov is not as accurate as it could be.
Right.
So that's one of the major questions. And another one is just...
Wait, that's a little unsettling. Healthcare.gov is not that accurate?
Well, there, especially this year with... Centene or Ambetter, they had just recently signed contracts with KU. So those doctors are now on their plans, but it's not on the website. And with some of the prescriptions, you actually need to go to the health insurance company's website. So,
okay. Our phone number here, if you have a question for how to get rolled for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, 816-235-2888. Again, you can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Catherine from Mission Hills. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so glad you're having this conversation because my son and I, it was insurance for him, who's 28. We just met with Jim earlier in the week, and I only happened to read about it in the Shawnee Mission Post about this free service to help you navigate through the marketplace. And we found a great plan, and we ended up with a silver plan. And in the past, we had always been looking for bronze, thinking that was like the better deal. And based on his income, it won't cost him anything, and he only has to pay $5 for a specialist, and we were just so pleased. And I don't know if everybody knows about this free help that's out there.
Yeah, Catherine, it was a pleasure meeting you and your son, and most people don't know that there is free help available.
Yeah.
And they also don't know that most people, 8 out of 10, qualify for financial assistance. So depending upon your household size and your income, you may qualify for a tax credit that defrays most of the cost of the insurance. Many people can find a plan for $75 or less in the marketplace.
You say 8 out of 10 people who try to enroll are eligible for financial assistance of one kind or another.
That is what we understand, yes. 8 out of 10 people qualify for some form of financial assistance to get insured through the marketplace. And if they do, the insurance quite often is affordable. So we encourage people to look into it.
Well, Catherine, I'm glad you had a good experience. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. I wonder what your message is, Jessica, to people out there who are wondering about this, who may be lacking coverage. What do you tell them to do? I mean, get enrolled, right? Does that go without saying?
I think definitely get enrolled and at least look around and have a look at what the options are. I think Catherine's story really highlights that, especially this year, people who might have historically shopped for a bronze plan or thought that it was unaffordable are finding occasionally some really surprisingly affordable options this year. So yeah. It's a really good year to have a look and shop around and see what the opportunities are out there.
You know, the other thing you hear out there, Molly, is just in the media that there are fewer and fewer insurance companies who are willing to play in this game of under the Affordable Care Act. When in this marketplace, do consumers have choices? Is there enough competition? What are we seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. In Johnson and Wyandotte County, we actually have two companies this year. It's Centene and Medica.
Okay.
Last year, we had Blue Cross and Blue Shield and Medica. And there's a wide variety of plans. And like Jessica was talking about, there are plans with lower deductibles and you might pay a little bit more out of pocket, but there are some good deals. And especially now with the different providers coming on into networks, there are better choices mm-hmm. than there had been.
Again, you also hear that under the Trump administration, the health insurance market has been destabilized to some extent. And that suggests, you know, fewer companies wanting to, enroll and work with the Affordable Care Act. But we're not seeing a whole lot of that here, or are we?
Not here, no. Mm-hmm. And they're actually, you know, with the Ambetter plan, there's quite a few different providers in network. And I don't know. I mean, just in our area, it's not. But I have seen it across the nation.
Why aren't we seeing more of that here? Why is this marketplace seemingly doing okay then?
That is a good question, but I'm going to give that one to Jessica.
You know, nationally, there was definitely a time period over the previous year where there was a real fear that there were going to be a number of counties that were considered bear counties, counties with no insurance
right.
being offered on the marketplace. And it looked like a real possibility for a while there. But I think what we've seen is a lot of kind of late entrance to the marketplace this year. Molly mentioned Centene on the Missouri marketplace. A lot of those insurers came in at the last minute and offered opportunities for insurance that wouldn't be there otherwise. So I think that's partially that a lot of insurance companies are just getting better at figuring out how to navigate this new marketplace and figuring out how they can offer products.
James, Annette Griggs asks us this. Are adults with no income who live at home with parents eligible for ACA?
It depends. It depends on whether or not their parents claim them as a dependent on their tax return. Typically, you will have to have a minimum amount of income in order to qualify for the financial help, and that's 100% of the poverty level. For a single person, that's a little above $12,000 a year. And if you're a family of four, it's more like $24,000. So it depends on your tax filing status, on your situation, on your citizenship and immigration,
so
things like that.
If you are a dependent, does that improve your chances for getting on the ACA if under the circumstances that Annette lays out here?
Well, yeah, you would need income in order to qualify for the tax credit. So if the parents that the adult lives with are claiming them as a dependent, they might be able to qualify based upon their parents' household income.
Okay. Let's keep going with some calls. Lots of them coming in here at 816-235-2888. We're talking about how to get enrolled in the ACA here. The deadline just a couple weeks off. Frank from Kansas City, Missouri.
Hey, there's a problem where I sign up and it says my kids might qualify for Medicaid, but last year I had to ask Missouri, and then I never got an answer from Missouri as to whether or not my kids actually qualified for Medicaid. And I would be happy to just say no and then proceed with the enrollment, but this year there's not like a little place where I can just, you know, pretend I got an answer and say no. It's so my kids currently are not signed up, but I am signed up. So
Molly Moffitt, you're nodding your head as Frank was talking there.
Yeah, this is a pretty common problem or just an issue. I've run into this a few times this year, and some people actually do qualify for Medicaid, and they're not aware. But then there is a glitch because we're a non-Medicaid expansion state where it says that someone does qualify and they actually don't. And my advice would be to meet with a navigator because they can actually help you get through the system and get a notification from Medicaid, and they will be able to send that off to the marketplace.
Jim, how do you help people? How do you coach people and help them prepare to enroll? What's the process?
Oh, that's a good question. We basically ask them questions about their family and household and income, who has earned income in the family, how many people are in the family, is anyone offered insurance through a job? These are really important questions. And then we'll ask them to bring, you know, names, dates of birth, social security numbers, and anybody that's working needs to bring like a recent pay stub because we want to look at their gross income.
And that's the information that anyone would need, even if they don't come to a navigator and they want to enroll online. You need to gather some information first, right?
Absolutely. Income and information on everyone in your family. And if you're self-employed, you'd need to look at a tax return to see what your income is after deducting expenses.
Okay. Charles from Mission on the Kansas side. Charles, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I have a quick question. So I'm self-employed, and I didn't qualify. I went to healthcare.gov, and I didn't qualify for any assistance. And there were only two plans on the Kansas side, and I was actually shocked how expensive they were. So what am I missing?
So that's based on not being qualified for financial assistance because they are pretty pricey if you don't end up qualifying. Yeah. And, you know, I honestly don't have much to say for folks in that situation because it's just where we are. Some of the plans are okay, but really the people who are getting the most help are the folks who.
Given Charles' circumstances, is he better off just going out in the marketplace and shopping around a little bit?
Well, in Kansas or in Johnson and Wyandotte County, those are the only two companies, period.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
that's
if you're not.
Yeah. I mean, mine's going up. You know, I'm losing the plan I'm on and it's really skyrocketing. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm scrambling to figure out what to do.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Charles. And that's a common predicament for lots of folks out there who are going through sticker shock here, I think. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, I appreciate your time, though.
Good luck, Charles.
Thanks. All right.
Bye-bye. Larry from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about how to get enrolled in the ACA. Good morning.
Yes. I wanted to call in with my experience. Earlier this year, Sears closed the store on Metcalf Avenue, and I'd worked for Sears for 32 years, and I lost my job. I lost my health insurance, obviously, also. I'm 61 with many pre-existing conditions, and I was scared to death. When November 1, I met with a navigator at the Kansas City Care Clinic. She was wonderful. We looked at the plans. Because of my greatly reduced income, I qualified for a tax credit that pays my entire premium. It's a silver plan with Cigna. I'm ecstatic. All I can say is when the Senate got within one vote of repealing the Affordable Care Act, I was literally having sleepless nights. I was so worried. But it's worked out well, and I hope to God that Congress never repeals this thing because it was literally a lifesaver for me.
Larry, great story. I'm glad you shared it. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You know, James, how clearly are the various plans, you know, laid out when you go to the healthcare.gov site? How clear is it all?
I think it's pretty clear. There's a good little tool on there. If you want to kind of window shop and see what you might pay or what you might qualify for, if you go to healthcare.gov and click on the search box, see plans and prices, it'll ask you a few questions like your family size, rough income, and whether or not you get offered insurance through a program like Medicaid or Medicare or work. And then it'll tell you how much credit you might qualify, how much financial assistance. And then you can actually look at the plans available in your area and see what you might pay after using the financial help. I think it's very useful.
Yeah. Before I forget, how much higher are premiums in our area compared to a year ago? Do we know, Molly?
I'm estimating anywhere from like 40 to 60%.
Is it that much, Jessica?
There's a really wide variety. I think you'll see some plans had jumps in the 20% range and some had up to an 80% range. It's important to know when we think about these prices increasing that the way the marketplace works is the financial help people are getting from the federal government is really ebbing and flowing with those changes. So while premiums are going up, and they would definitely be going up for the example of Charles who called in and didn't have any of that financial help, he would have seen those premiums go up in a really big way. But at the same time, those federal subsidies are going up. So for a lot of people who are able to qualify for that help, the increases are not as apparent and not really going to hit their own pocketbook.
Okay. And yet enrollment is up. Pretty amazing. Are you all surprised by what we're seeing out there right now?
Slightly.
Slightly because?
Slightly because I know that there's a lot of fear. We've had a lot of folks confused about whether or not the ACA is even still a thing.
Of course.
But then we've also been incredibly busy. So I'm very encouraged by that.
I'm going to grab one more call here from Christian from Kansas City, Missouri. Christian, you're on the air.
Hey, so I have a question
yes.
for you guys.
Yes, sir.
I've been enrolled since it went into effect, and I have had no issues except for the last year. I'm a resident alien from Canada, and they were saying my resident alien number was not valid and asked me repeatedly to submit a photocopy of my resident alien card. And basically, I came up to the deadline, and now I'm not insured. I don't know if you had any advice for this time around, if this is going to be an issue again.
Sure. I would try and make an appointment with a trained assister. We see that problem a lot at Samuel Rogers. We help a lot of immigrants, a lot of permanent residents apply. And you need to enter a lot of information on that permanent resident card, the alien number and the card number. And it's helpful to know where to look on the card. So if you need help, call 211 and we'll try and help you.
Wouldn't that be on record from previous years?
It should.
Same card, and I had no issues.
It should be, but we have seen this. One of our CACs who helps a lot of immigrants says that she runs into the thing where healthcare.gov asks them to verify their immigration status again when it was done the previous year. So that is a little bit frustrating and time-consuming, but we can help you with that.
Great. Thank you.
Christian, good luck. Again, the deadline for enrolling the ACA, December 15th, right? Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. Jessica Hembry with the Healthcare Foundation of Greater Kansas City. James Torres, Affordable Care Act Navigator with the Samuel U. Rogers Health Center. Molly Moffitt with the Community Health Council of Wyandotte County. Thank you all for some very practical information. Sure appreciate it. And speaking of healthcare and health, we're going to talk about chickens and what chickens can do to your health when we come back from a break. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Monday, we'll discuss political developments with a panel of pundits. We'll get their views on next year's governor's race in Kansas, the mayoral race in Kansas City coming up next year, the Senate seat up for grabs in Missouri, and, of course, President Donald Trump. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, I eat a lot of chicken. Maybe you do, too. But I can't help wonder about that decision after spending some time with Maren McKenna's new book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed the way the world eats. I hope you caught the key word there, antibiotics. Farmers have their chickens ingest them every day to keep them healthy, but then we eat the chickens along with those antibiotics, and that's a problem. The overuse of those antibiotics, not only in chicken, but in treating human diseases, can lead to drug-resistant bacteria. So eating all that chicken comes with some risk. Maren McKenna is an award-winning journalist who specializes in public health and food policy. She's the author of two other books, Superbug and Beating Back the Devil. And Maren, what a pleasure. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for having me.
Can I just point out that when you worked in a newsroom, I think it was at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, you were known as the Scary Disease Girl. Anything we should read into that?
That was me.
That was you, eh?
I think we described my beat as, oh, God, we're all going to die.
Yeah. Well, lots of people eat chicken, and they eat lots of it. How much is too much, and what should we be thinking about there?
So the first thing I want to say is that I eat chicken, too.
In fact, the beginning and
ending scenes of this book are scenes of me stuffing my face with delicious chicken.
That's right.
So I want to say from the start that I am a meat eater, and I wrote this book because I feel it's important as meat eaters that we should be able to examine the way that our meat is raised and ask questions about it because we want to see the system get better. So how much meat is too much? Well, we eat a lot of chicken in this country. It actually is the meat that we eat more than any other, more than 90 pounds per year American.
It didn't used to be that way 50 years ago, right?
It's true. Now, I mean, we raise almost 9 billion chickens in the United States every year. 1.4 billion of them in my home state of Georgia. And that didn't used to be the case. If you went back to our, say, our great-grandparents or great-grandparents' time, chicken was the thing that was out the back door or in the barnyard largely in order to produce eggs. And we mostly ate chickens. After their egg-laying days were done, when eggs hatched out as roosters, you don't need so many roosters in a flock, so those would get fattened up and eaten young. But chicken was mostly a thing that existed because of egg production. And if you think of a hen chasing chicks around a barnyard for a couple of years and scratching up bugs and flapping up into trees and so forth, all of that exercise might make her flesh very tasty, but it's probably also going to make it sinewy and chewy. And so, at first, back, you know, if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, chicken was something that was relatively rare in our diets and that we didn't think of as very delicious. And then a whole series of really technological innovations. Chicken and poultry is a surprising sort of nexus of lots of tech that makes it into the chicken that we eat today, all combined to make chicken this protein that's so common in our diets that we barely even see it, really.
Well, let's go back to this notion of the drug resistance here. To what extent is the eating of chicken then making us vulnerable to these bacterial infections that are so frightening?
So let me explain this because it takes it's sort of a multi-step process. Stick with me. Mm-hmm. So since the beginning of the antibiotic era, which is basically the end of World War II, we've been giving small doses of antibiotics in feed and water routinely to meat animals, in fact, to most of the meat animals on the planet. We do that because researchers discovered at the beginning of the antibiotic era that tiny doses of antibiotics, much smaller than ones that would cure an infection, can change the balance of bacteria in the guts of an animal so that that animal will put on weight more faster, will move through the production process faster. And a slightly larger dose, but again, one that's too small to cure an infection, will protect animals from picking up diseases in the crowded conditions of very large-scale farming. So since those antibiotics are going in the feed and water, they go into the animal's guts, they affect those bacteria that are in their guts. They turn those bacteria toward being drug resistant. And drug resistance is really just bacteria's attempts to protect themselves against the compounds that we send at them to kill them. And when those animals are disassembled into meat, some of those gut bacteria get on the meat. And while the animals are alive, some of those gut bacteria that are now resistant exit the animals through manure and contaminate the farm environment, flow away through ground and surface water, and blow away as dust on the wind. So the end result is that we are surrounded by drug-resistant bacteria that have their origin on farms and that pose a risk not just through the meat we eat, but also through other environmental and other pathways that we're really not aware of.
So what happens then to get to the end point here, the scary point, when antibiotics can no longer work anymore? Because I know you gave a TED Talk on this topic that's been viewed like a zillion times. What happens?
So what happens is that we lose one of the most powerful tools in medicine. And I want to be clear here that we are losing antibiotics not just because of overuse in agriculture, but because of overuse in medicine as well. There's plenty of evidence that antibiotics are prescribed inappropriately. They're prescribed for too long or for the wrong thing. They're prescribed in ways that don't really work. But overall, what we've done since the 1940s, when we first got antibiotics, is to really not treat them as the precious things that they are. And so, if we completely lost antibiotics, whether it was from agricultural overuse or medical overuse, we would end up in a situation where very common injuries, scrapes, cuts, bruises, fevers of children, childbirth, simple surgeries, those things would be deadly. In fact, there's a story in my own family that my great uncle, who was a fireman in New York City, got sort of bumped and bruised at the firehouse one day in 1938. and several weeks later died of fulminating blood poisoning because there was nothing they could do to treat him. It was 3 years before the first human trial of penicillin, and we could be back there again.
You know, urinary tract infections in women can also play a role here. How so?
This is an astonishing story. This is something that when I started researching this book, I really had no idea about. I think people can sort of intuitively put together that if we give antibiotics to animals and then we eat the animals, the result might be foodborne infection, since we're talking about the animals becoming food, that happens to be drug resistant. But the whole urinary tract infection connection is so fascinating. What happens is this, you know, we eat the bacteria along with meat. Some of the bacteria survive cooking. They go into our guts, but they don't immediately cause a foodborne infection in the way Salmonella or Campylobacter or one of those foodborne organisms might. Instead, the bacteria in this case are E. coli that also have become resistant. They sort of start, they take up residence in our guts and they just kind of live there quiescently for a while. And then something happens. Maybe there's a change in our immune condition. Maybe we take some other antibiotics. But those bacteria get out of our guts. And this is particularly just because of anatomy. Women are particularly vulnerable to this. They get out of our guts and they get into our urinary systems. And they cause a bladder infection, a kidney infection. And then if they go untreated and a drug-resistant infection that gets antibiotics that don't work against it is effectively an untreated infection. That infection can keep going up through the kidneys, into the bloodstream, into other organs, and eventually kill people from septic shock.
Wow. Mary McKenna is my guest. Her new book, Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. We were talking about how much antibiotics that chicken ingest every day. Compare that to humans. How much does this compare to how much antibiotics we humans wind up taking in?
So it's a little hard to make this comparison because there isn't as much data as there really should be, and the data are collected and released at different times. But 1 year where all the data is very solid and all of the data sets match up is 2011, so 6 years ago now. In that year, almost 8 million pounds of antibiotics were sold in the United States for use in humans, and almost 30 million pounds were sold for use in animals, so more than four times as many. And the important point here that's a huge difference, even though there are lots and lots of animals in the country, obviously. But the key point is most of those almost 30 million pounds would not have gone to cure infections. And curing infections is the only reason we give antibiotics to people. In fact, if we give it for another reason in people, we call it inappropriate use and we seek to stop it. But but inappropriate use in the human sense is what we've been doing to farm animals for 70 years now.
You know, hopefully we'll talk a little later about what can be done here. And I know you talk about and write about how some chicken producers are giving up on antibiotics for their chickens. I'm wondering, what happens if our chickens don't take and don't eat antibiotics? What's the risk?
So precisely because of some forward-thinking producers who are taking antibiotics out of their production, very large-scale production, we're discovering that meat can still be produced in an efficient, consistent, high-throughput, industrial-scale manner without the use of antibiotics, and it doesn't hurt the birds, and it doesn't change the bottom line. The company that really led the way in exposing this is Purdue Farms, who are the fourth largest chicken company in America, you know, now run by the grandson of the founder. But the son of the founder, Frank Purdue, is the person who, if you're a baby boomer or a Gen Xer, you remember those commercials, "It takes a tough man to make a tender chicken." So that company, they decided a number of years ago that they wanted to investigate whether they could raise their millions and millions of birds without the use of antibiotics, because their customers were starting to express to them that this made them uncomfortable. And over a number of years, Purdue tried a whole bunch of things. They changed the birds' diets so that the birds were no longer eating the rendered protein from other slaughtered animals. They took out antibiotics and gave them herbs and beneficial bacteria. They allowed them to get more exercise. They allowed them to get sunlight on their feathers. All these things were sort of other ways that other things that stimulated the bird's immune systems in such a way that the company could go without antibiotics and satisfy their consumers. And in 2014, Jim Perdue, the current chairman, summoned a press conference in Washington, D.C., and out of nowhere, and stood up and announced that the company was going antibiotic-free. In fact, was almost there. And the rest of the poultry industry, not all, but most of the major poultry producers in the United States have followed their lead. And along with them, major food service companies like McDonald's, for instance, and Chick-fil-A, and now Taco Bell and Subway and so forth. Now, the other animals that make up our livestock, pigs and cattle and even turkeys, they're a little more complicated than chicken. But even those are, I think, are proceeding in this manner because they see, first, that it's possible to do, and second, that customers really, really want it.
Right. All this is good, right?
It is good. It's good, and yet, you know, I mean, it's a moment of real change. I was talking to someone about this yesterday who said, I almost can't believe that customers said they wanted something, then the companies actually did it.
Wow.
But in fact, that is in fact true. Now, you know, it's not 100%. There's still a lot of things to be learned. There are companies that are resisting this. And again, you know, kind of beef and pork are going to be harder.
Okay.
But it could make a really significant difference to both to the way meat's raised in the United States and to the risk of drug-resistant infections from the way we raise meat now.
Marin, what we're going to do, we're going to take a short break here. Then we're going to come back and continue our conversation about her new book, Big Chicken. We're having a little scratchiness in the line. We might call you on your landline, Marin. So we'll take a short break. We'll be right back with Marin McKenna and her book, Big Chicken.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3 and KCUR.org. Today on Science Friday, we discuss what the Internet would be like if the Federal Communications Commission ends net neutrality this month, plus how the new tax bill could affect grad students. Science Friday coming up today from 1 to 3 on KCUR 89.3. KCUR is supported by Brookside Neighborhood Shopping, Dining, and Services for nearly a century, including the Fiddly Fig, a destination for flowers, gifts, and home accents, and Brookside Barkery and Bath, now offering local pet food delivery. At 11:51, it's 49 degrees in Kansas City. We now get back to Up to Date on KCUR.
Okay, we're back with Marin McKenna and her book, Big Chicken. We hope our connection with her has been improved just a little bit. Marin, when did this practice of dishing up all these antibiotics to chickens begin back in the day? When did all this start?
The fascinating thing, and I didn't know this until I started researching this, is that all of this begins right as antibiotics come on the scene. So a little bit of history. Probably in, you know, high school biology, people learned about Alexander Fleming, who in 1928 left a window open in his laboratory in London, and something blew in the window and killed the plates of bacteria that he was working on. And that thing that killed them was a compound excreted by a mold that had come in through the window. Hmm. That compound became the first antibiotic, penicillin. But not until the 1940s. It took Fleming and his collaborators a while to actually develop it into a drug. So penicillin comes out in the midst of World War II and really makes a difference to the war in about 1943, and the other drugs that start the antibiotic era all by 1948, all just being used in humans. And then in 1948, one of the manufacturers of one of those drugs gets the idea that maybe they could also find a market for their drugs in animals. Hmm. And simultaneously, the food system is kind of suffering from the end of the war, because during the war, of course, there'd been a huge guaranteed market to all the soldiers and sailors deployed across the world. When that market goes away, the meat production system needs to cut costs to keep from having its economy crash entirely. And so they start feeding animals cheaper feed, and they need supplements to make the feed more nutritious. And one of the scientists at that company that makes one of the first antibiotics gets the idea to try the leftovers from their manufacturing of their antibiotic in the animal's feed. And when he weighs the chicks that are his experimental animals, chickens are the first ones to get these growth promoter antibiotics. He discovers that the ones that got the tiny antibiotic doses gained more than twice as much weight as birds that had not gotten a supplement at all. And out of that, this whole worldwide industry of giving antibiotics routinely to meat animals was born. Within 5 years, American farmers were giving...
These antibiotics have this upside, which is what you're leading to here, I think, is it makes chicken awfully, awfully cheap.
That's right. It made animals, chicken first, and then very quickly these antibiotics were given to pigs as well, and then it took a while longer before they were trialed in cattle. They made it possible to grow an animal more quickly. So you could either give the same amount of feed and get the animal through lesser feed for the same amount of time or the same amount of feed and get the animal out faster. One way or another, it started people thinking about birds first and then other animals as something that you could move rapidly through a production system, almost like an assembly line for cars.
Yeah.
And from that, we get the concentration of farming, we get much larger barns and much larger feedlots, we get all the things that together have contributed to our protein being extremely, maybe artificially, inexpensive.
And yet, scientists were warning even right from the start that all these antibiotics might not be a good thing. What were some of them saying?
You know, this is the kind of the heartbreaking thing about this story, is that there were warnings right at the beginning. In fact, even before that first experiment in 1948, Alexander Fleming, the discoverer of penicillin, had said in 1945, when he accepted the Nobel Prize, that if we underdosed people with antibiotics, then resistant bacteria would result and would undermine the action of these precious drugs. Now, Fleming didn't know it, but what he was describing was exactly what agriculture was going to start doing, which was underdosing animals for some purpose other than curing an infection.
Mm-hmm. The safety of eating chicken is our topic here. Where does the federal government come down on all this? And it sounds like the industry is changing right before our eyes right now, Marin. But what do the feds say about this, and how concerned have they been?
Well, it's really been a long battle. So for the first decade or so after this started, and it starts just about, 1948, 1950, the FDA grants licenses to use antibiotics in this manner in 1951. No one really thought there was any downside. And then in England, actually, there were the first outbreaks of drug-resistant foodborne illness, which had never existed in the world before. And the British government put controls on the practice of using antibiotics like this in 1969. Our government tried in 1977, as part of the Carter administration coming into D.C., very activist, wanting to do a lot of reforms, and their FDA commissioner tried to take away those FDA licenses for antibiotics in animals and was forestalled by congressional interference. Mm. So there was a stalemate for really decades in which antibiotic use in farm animals just proceeded and proceeded, but the government didn't do anything. And then in the Obama administration, things changed. And they put forth a set of regulations that went into effect in January of this year, just before the Obama administration left office, that in a not quite regulatory way, and not quite a law, but in a voluntary way, asked farming to change. They actually asked drug manufacturers to change the labels on agricultural antibiotics so they couldn't be used in one significant manner, in that manner of making animals put on weight more quickly. And kind of to everyone's surprise, the drug industry agreed. And so since January, growth promoter antibiotics, as they're called, have been functionally illegal in the United States. It doesn't mean that all antibiotic use in farm animals has gone away, and there's still further reforms to be made, but that things have started to change after so many decades of essentially stalemate is really encouraging.
Marin, I just got about 40 seconds left here. When we're in the store then, you say we should be reading the labels when we buy chickens. We're looking for what?
Please buy something that says raised without antibiotics or raised without critically important antibiotics. In some ways, that's even more important than organic because it will keep antibiotics from being overused and it will allow small and medium producers who can't compete just on price but can compete on values to enter into the market again.
That's Mary McKenna. Her new book, Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. Thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
My favorite show from this week, a conversation with Gail Lukasik about discovering her African-American heritage, which her mother had hidden for decades. You can find that at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tweet at us. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Prasky. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's show, the political pundits discuss a raft of races coming up in 2018. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Steven Steigman, Demi Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.